help me welcome our speaker tonight from the first speaker group in Quaker Town.
Good evening.
My name's Adam Alcoholic.
Yeah.
I'm the short wine variety. He's the most And, tonight I was on the B team. And on the way down, I got called up from one of our home group members, and the fellow who was supposed to speak for us tonight wasn't able to make it because of the weather. He was driving from Philly, so hopefully we'll get him up here soon. So, I was asked by Sarah if I'd be willing to speak, and I didn't say no. I'm actually nervous. This is my home group. I've been involved with this group, I guess, a little over 2.5 years. And, in the 2.5 years that I've been a part of this group, it's been really amazing. And, I love my home group. And there were times where, maybe some personalities maybe didn't work so well or flowed so well with my opinions and stuff like that. But I show up. Yeah, I show up. And that's what I was doing tonight. I picked up a new friend tonight, and we came down to the meeting, and that's when I got the phone call. So please, disregard the time. I'm one of those guys, I don't believe in the message. So, and that's where I'm at. My sobriety date is April 23, 1998. I recently had 15 years, and, there was a time in my sobriety that was more important to me than the actual quality of my sobriety, and I'll get in touch with that. What I do today is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I sit down with guys, as my sponsor was willing to sit down with me, and he shared his experience with me, and I share my experience with others. I do much better one-on-one talking to guys, and, looking out into a crowd of people. I'm glad that's not quite as packed as it usually is or has been. But I'm really nervous. And, what I represent today is the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, and those are our 12 steps. I don't get so much into the debate of whether or not I was born an alcoholic or later on in life I became an alcoholic. All I know is that when I drink, I don't know when I'm going to stop. And when I do stop, I don't know when I'm going to start again. And my answer to that would be as quick as possible. That's what makes me an alcoholic. It's not. It has nothing to do with the day I was born. It has nothing to do with my economic or social background. It has nothing to do with my ethnicity. Because if you look around the room, you see so many different types of people from all different walks of life. And yesterday I was sitting down with a guy who read the forwards and talked just about that. And I forget which one it was. I think it was the third forward. The first forward talked about the kind of people who are in AA, being the business type, and so forth. And I think our co-founders, Bill W. and Dr. Bob, would be smiling upon us to see all the lives that Alcoholics Anonymous has touched. And I was really grateful for that. The old timers paved the way for me to come into AA. The old timers paved the way, they said it doesn't matter how old you are. They said it doesn't matter how much you drink. It's what happens when you do drink. What are the feelings that come with that? I hear so many times in our rooms that, people, I've heard comments like, you're not the alcoholic that I am. Who am I to ever say something like that? Who am I to ever pass judgment? It's an individual decision, and it's a decision that I made because I know what happens when I drink. I know the feelings that come along with that. And the people that I talk to today, or the people that I listen to today, I try to relate to the feelings. Because I can easily pick out the differences. Very easily. I grew up in a very loving, caring household. And, I wouldn't say that drinking was the normal part of our lives. I grew up in a very loving family. I had older uncles that I looked up to. They played sports. I got involved in sports. My mother was a hardworking mother. My father, he was a hardworking father. there was a divorce between my father and my mother when I was about 2 years old, and you know, I think it was into all the therapeutic stuff that maybe was crossing my mind and stuff at the time, but you know, this is alcoholism. And later on, I'll share about the amends process and how important that was in that relationship. So, I do remember one thing, and we talked about step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and that our lives were unmanageable. I believe that I was powerless over alcohol even before I picked up a drink, and that my life was unmanageable before I picked up a drink. I remember Sunday afternoons after Mass, we would go back to my grandparents, and we would have macaroni and gravy dinner. And, you know, everybody had a glass of wine, even including the kids. But the kids didn't get as much as the grown-ups, obviously. But I always remember, like, comparing that, you know, my mom got a full glass, and I just got a little sip. Why is that? You know, that's, I remember thinking, like, that's not going to be, that's not enough. You know, and I didn't even know what stuff would do to me. You know, I was always comparing my insides to other people's outsides. I was always comparing. And, you know, that's something that I was doing even before the drink came into the picture. You know, I just kept running around at family picnics, and, you know, the uncle saying, I'm going to have a swig. You know, don't tell your mom. You know, that's not what makes me alcoholic. But I thought it was cool. You know, see, my perception, my outlook on things was gearing me up to become and cross that line into alcoholism. But that didn't make me an alcoholic at the time. You know. In fact, early on in high school, I was involved in sports. I got pretty decent grades. And I didn't like anybody that drank, did any other chemical, or even smoked cigarettes. Like, I just didn't hang around those people. I was either at the gym, studying, or, you know, going to the movies. You know, I was pretty much a normal teenage kid. And then the day came. You know, the first time I got drunk, I was 16 years old, which I don't know if it's average or late or whatever. But the first time I got drunk, we got the old head to go get us a couple 40s. And, you know, and of course, we paid him by getting him some booze. And then I drank, and I got drunk. And I know for me, like, I remember that night. I truly do. And I don't know how important it is to remember that night, but I do. So I guess I'm supposed to. And what happened that night was I got drunk. I got into a fight. I got a chick tooth. Almost got my ear ripped off my head. I don't remember the actual fight, but, you know, I got blood. And I don't even know what happened. I think what happened was, what I think happened was, I probably started running off at the mouth. You know? And I don't know who looked worse, me or him. I don't know. But, because that was something my dad always said. If I came home bloody, he'd be like, what does the other guy look like? But, you know, I don't know exactly what happened. All I know is I went to the hospital to get my ears fixed up, and later on went to the dentist to get the tooth fixed. But with all that stuff happening, I remember I did pass out on the couch at a friend's house, and I remember the thought to me was, I'm definitely going to do that again. You know, I'm definitely going to get drunk again. I'm definitely going to drink again. And for whatever reason, that phenomenon of craving that our book talks about came into play. And I know what that feels like. You know, I don't believe it. A non-alcoholic knows that. You know, I don't believe that. So, but I know for me, for this alcoholic, that phenomenon of craving started, and that's when everything started going downhill. That's when sports went out the window. In fact, I went out for football that summer. I think I made it through two practices. And I remember going to the coach and saying, I just don't have it in me anymore. That's when my academics started slipping. And, you know, I don't know what would have happened had I not stopped playing football, but I know that there was something else more important in my life. And alcohol, at that point, was my higher power. You know, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about an alcoholic cannot use alcohol in any form or another. So there are other forms. You know. And I'll leave it at that. But, so I started drinking. Started drinking, partying. in high school. And here's another, you know, area of unmanageability. I remember in high school, this was my junior year, and I remember going into school Monday and already thinking about who was throwing the party on Friday. You know, I wasn't thinking about academics, I wasn't thinking about studying, I wasn't even thinking about girls. I was thinking about getting drunk. And, you know, it's like, that consumed all my thoughts. You know, doing whatever we did before school, sneaking out to the tennis courts. And then my senior year, we had senior privileges, so you were only able to go out to lunch. And I remember I was the guy that had the keg in the trunk, and we went to somebody's house, got drunk. I went to Easton High School, so we'd go to Jimmy's Hot Dogs, get hot dogs, you know, because we thought that smelled, covered up the smell of the booze, with the mustard and the onions and stuff like that, and the, you know, the pickles. And that's what we did. You know, I'd drive around for that week or whatever, people would pitch in for this keg, and that's what we did. No matter how warm it was, no matter how disgusting or skunk it was beer. It was a way to get loaded on our lunch break and go back. And, I remember I had like government economics after lunch, and the teacher was really cool. He just kind of told me to go pass out in the back. You know, and I don't know, like my senior year, I ended up getting an A in that class. I didn't know that. I had no idea how, you know, either he was really sick of me and he just wanted me to get through, or I did some kind of work, I don't know. And I ended up barely graduating high school. That was probably the best grade I had. Everything else was not too well, but, the unmanageability started creeping in. On Mondays, I was already worried about the weekend, and I didn't care about anything else. You know, and then there were those days where we'd go out to lunch and come back drunk. And stood off of something. And I thought that this was cool. Like, I thought that that's what we did. You know, when you're a teenager, you experiment, you did whatever. You know, my mom told me stories of what she did when she was a teenager. Why couldn't I do it? You know, and if you compare her teenage life to mine, hers was definitely a lot more wild than mine was. But at some point, she grew up. She had children and grew up, and the drink was never a problem. It never had been a problem before. You know, graduated high school, and I'll tell you what, one thing, this year's another unmanageability example. I remember I got loaded on the day of my graduation. I was running with an older crew, so I was hanging out with older guys that had been out of school for like 3 or 4 years at the time. And I got loaded and went to my graduation, and I remember falling up the steps to go get my diploma. I remember turning around and looking, and, you know, there might have been, like, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 people, family members, sitting there, and my eyes went right to my parents and my grandparents, and just look at disgust on their face. You know, I don't know. Some people call that a God shot. I think it was. Yeah, because I have all those people there. I didn't know where they were sitting. I didn't even care where they were sitting. I just wanted to get my diploma, go out, and get loaded again. Drinking consumed my thoughts. So, you know, college was mentioned, and that went out just as fast as the word came out of somebody's mouth. You know, I thought I was going to be like my grandfather. I thought I was going to be like my old man. Like, you know, I'm going to go out and work. So, I got a job doing masonry work up in the Poconos, and I was good physical labor. You know, I started out laboring for the first couple months, and I started throwing some mud on a block, and next thing you know, I'm starting to place some blocks, and things are going pretty good, And it's funny, ironically enough, the guy that I worked for, they didn't drink at all. You know, you hear contractors and construction guys, you know, they drink while they're at work. You know, and this guy didn't tolerate any of that. So, needless to say, I stuck off. Since we were in the Poconos, you know, you could go off in the woods on your lunch break and do whatever you want there. You know, and come back and perform whatever it was that I performed. So, some reason it probably was like a show. But, and that's what I did. And some more unmanageability came along where I'd be driving up to work, going up 33 towards like East Stroudsburg and stuff. And next thing I know, I'm like falling asleep behind the wheel. And, I'm showing up to work just on time. See, because I needed a job to do what I wanted to do. You know, I wasn't too much of a thief. In fact, I wasn't very good at being a thief. You know. So I knew I had to work. I knew some work had to come into play so that I could pay for whatever it was I wanted. So So I'm driving this job, and, you know, I'm falling asleep behind the wheel. This is going on for a couple months. And I was at this job for like 6 months altogether. And, you know, I'm falling asleep behind the wheel, and the thought comes to me, like, you know, nothing about the drinking, but, like, you know, maybe I should look for something a little more local, because I don't want to get into an accident. And so I did. I hooked up with a contractor down in Easton. It was more local. We had more local work. And I started working for him. And I worked with a foreman who was just like me, miserable, nasty, smelled of booze. And it was me, one other guy actually that I graduated high school with, and this foreman. And, you know, looking at this guy, it was a mirror image. Now, I don't know if he was an alcoholic, but I know that he reminded me a lot of me. And I didn't like the person that I was so much that I hated this guy. And I couldn't stand him, and I walked off the job, and I go back to the office, and I told the boss, I said, dude, that guy's a complete whatever. And, you know, and I walked off. And I said, you know, just give me my pay at the end of the week, and I'll move on. And by this time, things, my drinking, started getting deeper and deeper. And, you know, it was very shortly after that I got a DUI. With all this stuff happening in July, my mom, and she started seeing stuff. And it's like one thing I used to joke about is my mom, she, at the time, she was putting herself through a master's program that was really intense. She was driving down to Kennett Square and then down to Philly on the weekends for classes. And her son's pretty much up here in the Lehigh Valley running amok. And, you know, I can't think of, you know, the night's sleep that maybe I robbed her of, or her own sanity. Like, I couldn't think about that stuff then. Because I was doing what I wanted to do. And the only person being affected by it was me, obviously. You know, because I'm the one doing it to myself. You know, not thinking about my loved ones or anything like that. And so I, she ended up kicking me out. And, you know, I laid on the guilt trip. And, you know, how could you kick your only son out, your youngest child? And, you know, wait until I tell Nan and Pop. And I tell you what, my grandparents took my son. You don't do that to your kids. You don't kick them out. I said, yeah, see, I told you so. But not once did I think about what was going on, what I was causing her. It was all about me. So I moved in with my sister. That was short-lived because I wasn't working. And I think I made a comment one night. Like, I don't even know what it was, but I made a comment. And she had enough of it. And I ended up moving in with my grandparents. And this was along with the jobs, the masonry job and working with the contractor. So, anyway, I lived with my grandparents, and on tax day of 1998, I got my DUI. I remember that night. And then I had my last drink. And I was drinking with a buddy of mine. I remember I drank a fifth or a fifth and a half of Southern Comfort, and we were smoking some stuff. And, you know, we just said we got the bright idea. Like, hey, you get drunk and you get a little diner, right? So we're up in Bangor, and we drive down to, we're heading toward TikTok, down on 25th and Northampton, down in Easton. And I'm probably like a quarter mile away. I'm driving down 248, apparently on the wrong side of the road. I don't quite remember, that's what the officer said. And it's a four-lane highway, two lanes going each way. I don't know how I missed that, but, you know, he pulled me over, and he said, you know why I pulled you over? I said, officer, I had no idea. And he said, well, you're driving on the wrong side of the road, and you're speeding. And I'm thinking to myself, God, this car goes faster backwards than it does forward. It's a little beat-up car. You know, it got me through high school, and it was a decent little car, but people are not speeding. But I did. I said to him, I know that I was at my end. And, you know, I told him, I said, listen, I'm drunk. I said, you know, my life sucks. I'm drunk. Do whatever you got to do. And did the field sobriety test, sat in the back of his cruiser, and off to bed by my way, and they did some blood work. And I remember my blood alcohol was 0.32 or something like that. You know, so it was pretty drunk, you know. But I do remember, like, coming out of that. I don't even know if it was a blackout, because I don't remember driving the way I was, but I do remember coming up to the window and thinking that, you know, I felt pretty normal, you know, where it talks about in our literature, like, our alcoholic life becomes the only normal thing that we know. Like, I thought everybody drank the way that I did. I was hanging out with guys that drank the way that I did. Now, if you look at those guys today, they don't drink the way we did. You know, they're not alcoholics. They're one of my good buddies that I went to high school with. He's pretty successful with his own business, and, you know, he was the guy who told me to slow down. You know. So, one of my favorite lines from Bill W.'s story is with this newfound God of consciousness, you know, what was once common sense is now uncommon sense. The way that I was living and the way that I was drinking is definitely uncommon sense today. You know, I believe that I have been put in a position of neutrality based upon my spiritual condition with my God, and that I have been restored to sanity. Yeah. I go off to rehab because I think, okay, well, maybe this will lower fines and, you know, make it look good for the courts. And I got out and I went to a recovery house. I lived down in Chester County. The first 12 years I was sober, I lived down in that area between Montgomery County and Chester County, Pottstown area, Springford, and so forth, Rutherford. Then I lived down there for my first 12 years. And 2 years sober, I got a job at the rehab I was a patient at. And, you know, things were going pretty well. And, you know, I had done some step work. I had gotten a sponsor. I was probably, within my first 2 years, on 3 sponsors. One fella had moved out of town. He moved out to Ohio. So I'd get a new sponsor. The other guy, his life was just really crazy with a lot of stuff. And, you know, we weren't able to sit down as often. We had some young kids going through a divorce. And then the third guy, Don F., you know, the reason I chose him is because at the time he had like 30-some years sober. And, you know, this is the guy that's going to take me through the work. And, you know, we're going to do this gig together. And but the thing that I was missing was the willingness. I was missing the willingness of us. You know, and I did a half-assed school step. You know, looking back, I did. Because at that time, I thought I was being as honest as I could be. And maybe I was. You know, we sat down and talked about some stuff, you know, with a fifth step. And that's where I stopped. You know, that first fourth step, you know, might have been what would have gotten me through whatever was coming up. But I stopped doing step work. You know, so I was one of those guys that did steps 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then stopped. Then I went right to 12 and, you know, wanted to try to help people, you know. That's always kind of been in my nature, trying to help others, you know. Like I said, I come from a good family, good morals, good spiritual principles have been instilled in me. But none of those spiritual principles were able to touch my life like the spiritual principles that we talked about in AA. You know, that we talked about the 12 steps. And those spiritual principles that I was taught as a kid, I've come to realize are pretty much the same as the ones hanging on this wall. And it's not anything that Phil W. or Dr. Bob came up with. They've been around for thousands of years. It's just that we apply them to the alcoholic. Or they did. You know, so anyway, you know, I was working in a rehab. Things were going well. I was going to meetings. I was things were going pretty good, you know. And then I stopped doing the work. I stopped moving my feet. I stopped moving forward. And because even at that point, I didn't hear. Not that it was ever not told to me what makes me an alcoholic. I still didn't know exactly what made me an alcoholic. I knew that I couldn't drink because bad things happened when I drink, you know. I didn't understand the whole when you drink, what happens. When you stop drinking, what happens. I didn't understand that. See, I thought I was reading the date book because I went to date book meetings. You know, my sponsor at the time, he had me working out of the 12 as well, which I had nothing against it. But what I found is that in the date book of Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, it was a lot simpler. There's direction in our date book. There's direction. It points you in a direction. So anyway, got out, got a new car. I was excited about that. You know, that was my higher power for a little bit. Moved out with some friends, lived with them for about a year, got a girlfriend. We ended up getting a nice apartment, an old farmhouse out in, by the Limerick Airport, if anybody's familiar with that. You know, things were falling into place. And at 5 years sober, I started having panic attacks again. Well, not again. I started having panic attacks. And so I thought, okay, well, I haven't been to a meeting. Like, I started slacking on meetings and stuff. And so I started going back to meetings, and I got back into therapy. And I remember the counselor that I had at the time. She's in recovery, and she's got about 40 years sober now. And she said, "Hey, you can do whatever it is that you want to do. You can make all the meetings you want, but if there's something else going on, you may need to look into other alternatives." And I was completely against any type of medication. And I'm going to leave it at that, okay? Because I'm not a doctor. I know what works for me. And the sponsor that I have today, he knows what works for me. I share with him what works for me. And we're okay with that. So I had to look outside of Alcoholics Anonymous for help in other areas, and that's okay because, AA doesn't claim to be a physician or a doctor or a lawyer or a money lender or anything like that. So I did that, and I was going back to meetings, and I was making more meetings, and things got better. This relationship that I was in started deteriorating. See, I was still running the show for all of this, too. I was still running the show, even things were going pretty good, I was still at this job. I had taken a promotion. I had gone from being a tech to working in the materials management department. At 9 years sober, I remember I was at a meeting, and there was one personality in there. This person said something to me that just set me off. And see, I was already in a business of treated alcoholism and didn't even know it. This person said something that set me off, and I walked away from AA for the next 3 years. Until I came in broken more without a drink than I came in with a drink. And that emotional bottom and untreated alcoholism and not even know it. At 12 years sober, that job that I liked, that I had gotten different promotions in, by this time I was running the purchasing department. I was the man. They came to me, they called me to HR, and they said, we're going to lay you off, lack of work, whatever you want to call it. They said, we're going to allow you to collect unemployment. And this is how dry I was. I looked at them dead in the eyes and I said, you're going to allow me to? They said, it's my God-given right to collect unemployment for you people. Because by the end of this job, I thought it was okay to walk up and down the hallway saying that you don't pay me enough. That I could run this place better than the CEO. And the CEO's office was probably from me to where Paul's standing. That's how dry I was. That's how much in control I thought I was in. And they let me go. They could have just fired me. They really could. So I thought, okay, well, this is my opportunity. I'll move back to Lehigh Valley, and I come back up to Lehigh Valley, and I thought, I'll be closer to my grandparents, because it was all wrapped in good intentions. Everything was wrapped in good intentions. I moved back in with my mom. I could be in service a little bit more for my grandparents. I could see my family more often. And that's all good stuff, you would think. But what was going on the inside was that I was still dying and didn't even know it. So I moved in with my mom, and I remodeled the attic because that was going to be where I stayed. And I was laid off for 2.5 months, and I gone on a couple job interviews. Now, meanwhile, I could count on one hand how many meetings I'd been to in those previous 3 years. With all this stuff going on, the writing was on the wall. That summer I went on a vacation up to Maine with my mom, my nephew, my mom's dog, my uncle, my aunt, their dogs, and it was miserable because my attitude sucked. My attitude was absolutely horrible. I didn't treat my mother with any respect, and it was just really tough. I was laid off 2.5 months, and I went to a job interview, and the next day they called me up and offered me the job. It was a local hospital up in Ellendale. And one of those things where I was sitting in the interview and they brought up the pay. I know never to bring that up unless it's like a second or third interview. But I was there for one interview. They told me the salary and almost fell out of the chair. That's when I arrived. That's when I felt that, when I can look back and feel like Bill felt when he had arrived. See, because I was an untreated alcoholic, and that job was my dream. The brand new car sitting in the driveway was my dream. They were all my higher power. And, I could wear a shirt and tie now if I could feel important. And, I could start pushing people around. And listen, I was still on the bottom of the food chain, but the salary was really good. for a single guy, you know, it was really good. And so I took that job. 3 months later, I lost that job. Plain and simple. I would treat alcoholism brought me to a point where I was better off probably drinking because I wanted to kill myself. You know, I heard, when I first came to this meeting, one of the first people that I heard speak, he said, you know, one of the main reasons why people relapse is because they can't handle sobriety. And then they go back to drinking, and they can't handle drinking. So they come into sobriety, and they stay sober for a while, and they can't handle that. You know, and that's exactly what it was. I wanted to die. In fact, before I lost that job, I had gone to a meeting in West Bethlehem, and I met the man who's my sponsor today, and a friend of his, and they stood outside and they talked to me. And they, you know, my sponsor said to me, he said, "Hey, you're going through what you're suffering from is untreated alcoholism," and that hit me right between the eyes. Now, he'd probably tell you a different story, but I was a clutch fist. I was a clutch fist. That's what he saw. But what I was feeling was scared, fearful, wanting to die. You know? And, you know, we talked for a little while, and that night, this is how my mind plays tricks on me. That night, I had my own mother driving me to the hospital, and I'm in Florida to put me on the cycle at that hospital. And so I called this man that I met earlier that day, and he said, "Hey, don't start that paperwork." He said, "We talked about this." He said, "Why don't you go home and do some reading? Why don't you read the doctor's opinion?" I never read the doctor's opinion. And if I did, it was at an AA meeting. I never sat down to study this book. I never looked at this book as a textbook. So that's what I did. And 2 days later, I lost that job. To bring a new car, got repoed. All my credit cards stopped paying them because I couldn't afford it. Fortunately, I was able to collect again. Within a couple months, I had a small part-time job working for the Alexander School District. I was making a meeting up in Bethlehem, seeing my friends James, that's plural, and I just started getting back into meetings and stuff, and I would talk to people and just say, you know, I'm like really struggling because I didn't understand at 12 years without a drink how I could get to this spot. And after about 3 weeks of this losing the job, 2 or 3 weeks, I asked my sponsor to sponsor me. We were talking one day, and he was getting ready to actually with some group members from here go up to New York and do what was it like 86 meetings in 2 days or something, whatever it was. And you know, I remember. I don't know how possible that is, but it sounded good. I remember him telling me this, and I remember him also saying, you know, why don't you come down to my home group and meet Monday nights? We're down at Quick Chat. And honestly, the first week, I couldn't make it because I did have an appointment, but the following week, he mentioned it again. I said, what do I have to lose? And I came to this meeting, and I remember the gal that stood up there and spoke. Don't remember her name, but I remember she was attractive. And, you know, I didn't hear much of the story. She was attractive, and that's what I did. And you know what? I think maybe in the past 2.5 years, maybe I missed this meeting 3 or 4 times because of life events. The other thing too is I'm the GSR for this meeting, and it falls every third Monday of the month. And so what I usually do is I pick guys up, drop them off, and I go to the district meeting, and I pick them up afterwards. You know. That's the only excuse I have for missing my own group, is that I show up and I show up to the business meetings. And I'm able to share my opinion in those business meetings if there's an issue. So anyway, to go back, started working the steps with my sponsor, and he started me on the 4-step right away. We talked about God. He had me read the doctor's opinion. He had me read Bill's story and more about alcoholism, and there is a solution, and we agnostics. And I remember one night I was going to the men's meeting in Reyes, the men's staff meeting on a Thursday night, and I showed up like 2.5 hours early, and I pulled my big book out, and I read We Agnostics. And I totally related, like, I knew that I had that fundamental idea of a power greater than me. I knew that. Like, I had that from my childhood. The only thing is, I didn't believe that this power wanted anything to do with me. You know, and at that time, one of the groups up in Bethlehem, you know, took commitments at the intergroup office, and I know a few Wednesdays I would go there, and I would sit down with a gentleman, and I remember looking across the table, and I said to him, I said, you know, what makes you think that God wants to have anything to do with us? And he looks at me, he looks down his glasses, he said, very simply, man, he said, he created it. That's how simple this alcoholic has to keep it. You know, because in our book it talks about God is everything for his own. You know, and I was one of those guys that would walk around saying, like, you know, God's more selfish than I am. Everything has to be his way. Everything has to go God's way. You know, and an old timer pulled me aside one time and he said, you know what? Maybe because God knows what's better for you, then you know what's better for you. Yeah, but it's still got to be his way, you know, and that's just where I was at the time. You know, but you know what? It can be his way. I might put my hands in on it and mess it up every once in a while, but you know what? I step back and I can look at, I can see a bigger picture than what I used to see. You know, that's my second step. My second step is I believe, you know. I'm willing to believe that my sponsor believes. I'm willing to believe that people that show up to AA meetings believe. I'm willing to believe that these principles behind me will work if I work them, if I do the work. You know, AA was my first higher power after alcohol, of course. You know, I came to AA meetings and I had faith that, you know what, I see these people every day, or just about at every meeting that I go to. Something's got to be working. And again, this is 12 years without a drink. I was a newcomer all over again. I was physically sober. That's it. I was not in recovery. You know? And so we moved on and with the third step and we started reading how it works and stuff. And you know, I'm no longer in charge. I had to accept a new employer, a new father. I had to be the child to this power greater than me. You know? And I didn't understand how any of this was going to work, believe me. I didn't know how it was going to work. But I started, you know, I saw how it worked in other people's lives. You know, I still have that bad habit of comparing my insides to other people's outsides. That's a horrible character defect of mine. And that came out of the fifth step. You know, so my sponsor moves me on to the fourth step, and I was still practicing some not-so-good behaviors. And I remember I called my sponsor up, and I told him about this not-so-good behavior. You know, he said, hey, he said, Blaine, like, the guilt, shame, and remorse after this event was horrible. It was on me. Like, I knew it was over. And he said, stop doing it. Start talking to God. You know? Go back to your third step. You've got a new employer. He's got a job for you to do, and it's not that. See, because, I mean, females are higher power. You know, and I mean, the good feelings from females by higher power. You know, I'll look for anything to get outside of me. But if I'm honestly doing this work, I'm going to feel guilt, shame, and remorse if I act the way I used to. I saw something a couple years back. It was printed on a hat. It says, it's not old behavior if you just did it. You know, and how true that is for this alcoholic. You know, so what happened was after that, you know, I started writing down the four step. I remember even like Monday nights after this meeting, okay, it's like fresh in my mind and I'm writing this list. And, you know, I work in inventory control. So, you know, it's just pretty ironic how I work in inventory control. And what I'm doing in my job, in my everyday job, is getting rid of unsaleable goods. And I'm calling the vendor and I'm saying, hey, can you swap this for something that we can use? Our doctors are not using this anymore. You know? Fourth step. You know, any business that does not take regular inventory folds. Any alcoholic like me, that I don't go inside and start cleaning out that wreckage, I fold. I come up with excuses and say, hey, it does not work. I start judging people. So I want to be clear of all this stuff. So I got the list, I got the people, I've got the sex conduct, I've got the fears, and, you know, one thing that my sponsor did with me was he had me do an assets and liabilities. You know, what I found out from doing the fifth step is what came out of that was the extent of my character defects. Fear, self-centeredness, you know, those are the two big ones. you know. And the fear for me is, you know, comparing myself to others, people pleasing and stuff like that. I want everybody to like me. Yeah. I want to like everybody. It's not fair for me to not like somebody and still want everybody else to like me. It's not fair. So anyway, we sit down, we do this fifth step. We met here on a Saturday morning, and after that we left. Holy cow, very well. Yeah, we left and we go back to his place. And that night I was speaking at my first hour speaker meeting. And one of the goals that I had set and discussed with him was, I'd like to complete my fifth step before I speak. And he said, well, let's do it. This was a couple months ahead of time. And we were able to do that. And I tell you what, we sat down for about 5 hours. And I started feeling better. And each smoke break I went out, I felt a little bit better. And so forth. And I left there and I followed the direction of the fifth step and I went home and took that hour, reflected on the first 5 steps, proposals. Did I leave anything out? Did I omit anything? And at that time, honestly, for the first time in my life, the most honest answer I could give myself was I didn't miss anything. See, I was willing this time. I was willing to give this time at this program an honest shot. Because although your coffee was good, your dances were nice, and your cake tasted good, that didn't work for me. And 6 and 7, you know, it's about taking these character defects and becoming willing. And the 7th step prayer, although I do not have it memorized, I know that what it talks about is God wants to have that relationship with me. When I was talking about the 3rd step with the fellow at the intergroup office, this is when I found out that God loves me, that He wants the best for me, and that, you know, if I do the work, He's going to help me out. I mean, I get the results that I want, and I was talking about this on the way down. We're not in the business of results. We're in the business of action. You know, life's going to happen. Life gets life. And that's okay. I can accept it a lot easier today. And if I can't, I have people to call. The 8th step, having found out that God does love me and as one of His children, and, a lot of life events that were going on at the time and stuff like that. I moved into the 8th step and we went over this list of people. And I do remember that after my 5th step, my sponsor said to me, he said, there's 2 people you need to make amends to like yesterday. One of them was my father, and the other one was this friend that I walked away from AA, and I blame that person for. And with my father, I went to a meeting, and this woman who shared something that was like astonishing, and her sponsor told her that she still had to make it amends to her father, and I'm like, oh my God, if she can do it, there's no reason why I can't. I left the meeting that night, it was the Stringstown meeting. Left the meeting that night, and I called my dad. And I said, Dad, it's Ed. He said, I know who it is. I said, I need to talk to you. I said, when can you get together? He said, how's tomorrow? I said, that's great. He said, what time? I said, 9 o'clock work? He said, sure. I said, you want me to pick up any coffee? He said, I'll have a pot on. And I hung up the phone. And I called my sponsor, and I was in tears. And I said, I'm going to meet with my father. He said, great. Now, why don't you come down? There's a dance. There's an event going on somewhere around Brothers Lansdale or whatever. And in I walk, and I see this woman that I have to make amends to, that my sponsor said. You know, God shot. You know, and I talked to her, and I said, you know, I'd really like to get together with you and your husband, because I need to talk to you. And she said, Dad, it's no problem. I said, it is a problem. I said, I have to talk to you. I don't want to drink again. And she looked at me with that seriousness. And in the upcoming months, I was able to go down to Pottstown. I was asked to speak at a meeting down there that her husband asked me to speak at. Spent the weekend at their place. On the way to Shady Maple on Saturday morning, I'm talking to them. And I'm trying to, and I'm cleaning my side of the street. And I'm freeing them. Yeah. And those are just 2. This past Thanksgiving, I'm at the big Houston Beaver game. Yeah, I go every year, you know, and that's like the Thanksgiving thing in my family. And there was this guy that I played football with, and there's so much politics involved in sports and stuff. And, you know, I had a resentment against this guy, and he was a childhood friend. You know, we grew up together. He ended up playing Division I football at Wake Forest, and he's about like this tall, and, you know, really, really great athlete. And, you know, I ran into him, and he's walking down the corridor with his kid on his shoulder, and I'm like, my initial reaction was to just turn around and walk away. And but you know, it's almost in a God's honest truth. It's almost like I was pushed in his direction. And I said, Vince, I said, what's going on, man? And he's like, Eddie. He's like, yeah, it's been a long time. And I said, you know, and we're friends on Facebook and stuff. But I said, listen, I said, you got a minute? And he said, sure. Now, I can go into the whole resentment because his child is there. And earlier, before the game, he was recognized for his accomplishments as a football player for the high school that we went to. And, you know, I said, I just wanted to congratulate you. I said, you know, I was a teammate of yours, and I said, you know, we battled for the same position, and I won, by the way. but he got moved out. He was a big guy, so he needed to be a tackle. Put the short, fat guy in the middle. So, yeah, the fire plug. So, anyways, you know, we're talking and stuff, and I said, you know, Vince, I said, it's really great to see you. And he said, what's going on with you? We're in the same line of work. He's in procurement, works for Volvo down in North Carolina. And I said, oh, that's great. And I said, you know what? I said, next time you're in town, let's get in touch. And let's go up for coffee or something if you have the time. I said, I know you come up to spend time with your family. And he looked at me, and this is when God told me it was okay. He looked at me, and he said, when I think about my childhood, he said, you were one of the best friends that I've ever had. And the sad thing is, the ism was already there at that age when I was a kid, and I didn't see it. He said, Ed, I have so many fond memories hanging out with you. You know, even in high school, after football practice, we'd go back to his place to sit in the hot tub. I didn't remember any of that stuff. I do remember one time I sat in his hot tub and I was so cramped up, it felt like my knee was going to bounce up and hit me in the face. That was pretty painful. But, you know, just his perspective and my perspective were completely different. Today I can see that. Maybe I was a decent kid. I'm sure that I was a decent kid. I was taught good morals. I was taught by good people. You know. 10, 11, and 12. You know, I always got confused with step 10. I always thought it was the thing that I had to do at night. That, you know, if I upset anybody during the day, I carried that around all day, and I asked God for forgiveness at night. And until I got into the book, see, that's from what I've seen. And from what I've heard in meetings, that is a horrible misconception of the 10th step. You know, I've heard people say that. And I feel that it's my responsibility as a recovered alcoholic to say, no, that's not what it talks about. In fact, when I have days at work where maybe I make a mistake, I can own up to it. I can clean my side of the street. When I say something to somebody that might be offensive, I can clean my side of the street and say, I will do my best to make sure it does not happen again. You know, the key word in the 10th step is conflict. You know? And the direction of the 10th step is that when I find that I'm bothered, you know, first of all, I remove myself from the situation. I ask God for some kind of peace. I call somebody else or talk to somebody else. And then I go make the wrong right. Promptly. Not next month. Not next year. See, because one thing I found out is if I was carrying this to the end of the night before I went to bed, I didn't get a good night's sleep. That was on my mind. That was on my heart. And if I'm doing this program and practicing this program to the best of my ability, my conscience is going to say, you're not going to sleep tonight because you got to write it wrong. You know? The 11th step is where I go at the end of the night and I think about the day and I talk to God. And I say, thank you for another day sober. You know, thank you for allowing me to maybe write a mistake. You know, and when I wake up in the morning, I ask for direction and ask him what he would have me do. You know, and it's not about what I want to do because I was sitting talking to a friend last night for a good hour and 20 minutes or so. And I looked at him and I said, you know what, I'd rather be sleeping right now. But God's got me sitting in front of you. Because we're talking about something that's part of my experience, and if I can try to help somebody else out with my own experience, that's wonderful. AA has taught me to carry the message, not the alcohol. I'm not going to be the one to get everybody sober. You know, in the foreword yesterday, one of the things that we read was AA has only touched a very small fraction of the alcoholic problem in the world. I thank God that it has touched my life, that it has given me a solution, that I've gotten a message from that solution, and that I can sit down with the people that God wants me to sit down with. I remember a couple months back, I was calling my sponsor, I was sponsoring this guy, and it just was, you know, maybe trying to maybe control the situation, or, you know, I was feeling as though that I was carrying the alcoholic, and it was interfering with the message that I carry, you know, and my sponsor said to me, he said, you know, you're not getting rid of him. You're going to sit with him. Patience and tolerance is our code. You're going to sit with him and you're going to talk to him and you're going to keep sharing your experience with him. You're going to talk about the steps. You're going to do these things. You're going to read out of the big book. If he shows up, you're going to do all that. And if he doesn't want it, he'll fire you. And that's exactly what happened. And I'm okay with that. I am so glad that I didn't stop. I'm so glad that I still showed up. I'm so glad that, you know, I was able to be in service to him. To the best of my ability. And when he came to me and said, I don't think this is working out, I said, okay. No, actually, he came to me and he said, you can't sponsor me anymore. I said, oh, I can sponsor you. I can. I'm capable of sponsoring you. How willing are you to be sponsored by me? And I said, that's something for you to think about. I said, and he said to me, he said, well, you still go to this Tuesday night meeting, can I go with you? I said, absolutely. You'll have a spot in my car. Yeah. That's what AA teaches me. I'm not going to be the one to carry this message to every single person. I believe that I'm going to be the one to carry this message to the people that I'm supposed to carry it to. You know, and God already has that picked out for me. It's my responsibility to show up at meetings like this. It's my responsibility to put my hand up and share a message of hope in a meeting. Not a mess. Not the job sucks. Not my mom pissed me off. Not the significant other is getting under my skin. You know, it's my responsibility to share the hope that I've gotten through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And unfortunately, I go to meetings that don't talk about that. Am I the one that's supposed to bring a message like that? Maybe, because that's the message that I have. And it's not about me sitting in there, you know, thinking that I've got the answers, because believe me, the longer I'm sober, it's true what people say, the longer you're sober, the less you know. The longer I'm sober, the less I know, the more I need to get to God. You know, one thing that I like to share is, and I'll close on this, Dr. Bob, one of the things that he wrote the perfect prescription for the alcoholic. And he said it in three statements, which sums up our 12 steps. Trust God, clean house, and help others. I thank Sarah for calling me up tonight. Hopefully, the fellow who was supposed to speak for us made it home safely, because it is pretty ugly out there. I'm grateful to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to be a part of this home group. I'm grateful that God put people in my life to, it's kind of like, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. That's what AA is. That's exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And you know what the payoff at the end is? Carry the message to the next person. Carry the message to the next person. Pay it forward. So, that's all I have. Thanks for listening.
Sponsor. Please see someone after the meeting, but anyone who has working knowledge of the 12 steps, please raise your hands. If you're hurting people, see one of the people who's got their hand up. You can help with God's help. Today is like a really super special anniversary, and I had a friend that wants to say a word in regards to it. You tell me, welcome, Jeff.
Thank you. I just want to read something real quick. You know, I kind of touched on it, and it's something that really, I got a couple texts from some people today. And today is the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous, 7 years ago today. And for Forrest, and you know, I think there's a lot of really awesome stuff in the Forrest, and I just want to read a couple paragraphs real quick, and I'll take up much of your time. It's the spark that was the flare into the first AA group which struck in Akron, Ohio in June 1935, during a talk between the New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience. Following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford group of that day, he had been so greatly helped by a late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members, and his story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. From this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution of those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief and dependence upon God. Prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. But he had succeeded only in keeping himself sober. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be that Akron physician. This physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy personality with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. He sobered, never drank again, up to the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another, as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital from the recovery. And you know, those two guys turned into three, and three became 40, and 40 became 100, and 100 became thousands. And today there's millions. It's over 2 million. 100,000 group, 100 in here, I think in the fourth edition it says 100,800 AA groups in 150 different countries. Pretty amazing that we're all part of that miracle that happened this day, 78 years ago. So just keep that in mind as you leave here tonight. Thanks.